KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. A conservative media company might buy another Seattle TV station. Would this move, as John Oliver says, put Fox-worthy content into the mouths of our local TV anchors? Maybe, maybe not. We'll get into that topic in about a half an hour, so stick around. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Listen, you're going to vote, aren't you? If you live in Seattle, you've got 3 weeks to help narrow down the candidates for mayor. Your primary ballot is due Tuesday, August 1st. So KUOW is helping you get to know the leading candidates. And today's candidate, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. Welcome back, Mike.
Glad to be here.
Now, some listeners don't know you because they just moved here. Have you heard that's a trend? There's a lot of people moving here.
I think I saw the number was 500 a week, I think was the number, new people.
Well, let's do a get to know you then. Former mayor, local Sierra Club chairman, you once kayaked to Bill Gates' house.
Yeah, kayaked out to protest Shell Oil. We wanted the That was a separate one. So the Gates Foundation one was I worked with folks at 350 Seattle and a broad coalition to urge the Gates Foundation to divest from fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. Anything else we ought to know about you?
Oh,
for now, before I start firing away?
Yeah, you know, live in Greenwood, 3 kids, really active in my neighborhood association, really active with the Sierra Club, founded my own profit to work on environmental sustainability, and I'm just really passionate about how do we build a better future, which is why I ran the first time and why I'm running again.
Well, we have some questions for you.
Sure.
I do, as you know, I've got to ask, why aren't you mayor? Right? Why didn't you win your reelection campaign years ago?
It was close.
Yeah.
We should start right there. It was a very close race. It was a very close race in 2009. I think I won with 51%, and I think the next race was 47.5. You know, I was obviously new. That was my first elected office. I was coming in as an outsider, so I had to figure out, how to do the job and how to work on things. I'm proud of all the things we accomplished. But I think I ended my 4 years a little bit of an outsider, too. Kind of the powers that be weren't so happy with me standing up against, you know, boondoggle projects or trying to redirect dollars to benefit communities of color and low-income service workers.
From mayor to outside candidate.
I know, but I was. It was really funny being 4 years in the mayor's office, and frankly, I was taking on some pretty powerful interests from day one, and I never backed down, and neither did they. So they got their candidate in last time in a close race. That candidate is now out. They're rallying behind their new candidate. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have poured into the Chamber of Commerce candidate. You know, the rich people and the wealthy donors know who they like. And, I'm going in for another go-round because I think this city belongs to all of us.
Well, you're mentioning the endorsee of the chamber. That's Jenny Durkan. But we've got so many candidates to choose mm-hmm. from. I want to know first, are you advocating anything on, let's say, homeless policy, criminal justice, taxes? Are you advocating anything that no one else is?
Well, I came forward with tax fairness plan just last week. And one of the first things we need to do is first identify unneeded spending in the budget. The city budget has grown $250 million over the last 3 years. That's a 25% increase. Yet we're told by City Hall that we don't have money for things like homelessness. So first thing in is get there in the budget, cut unneeded spending. I believe I cut $67 million from the budget in 2010 when we had to balance the budget. I think I could find $30 or $40 million right away for priorities, and that's equitable neighborhood investments and investments in homelessness. If we need to raise taxes, I'm going to hold the line on regressive taxes. No increases in the sales tax, and we're going to hold the line on property taxes. It should only go up with the rate of inflation. If we need more dollars, we should look at the big successful corporations that are doing so well in this town. And I'm the only candidate who's laid that out as a platform.
Why hasn't the city taxed corporations more up to now if it's so doable?
Well,
and when you were mayor, when you were mayor yourself?
Sure. In fact, in 2009, when I ran, the city council eliminated by, I think it was close to a unanimous vote, a tax on big companies where you could charge a flat amount per employee they have.
The head tax.
Yeah, or the employee hours tax is what it's called.
Okay.
You know, Redmond does it at $109 per employee. That's how they fund themselves off of Microsoft that way. We could raise $30 or $40 million a year that way as well, you know, if we wanted to invest in more affordable housing, for example, or if we wanted to improve transit. You know, that's a tax source that's available without going to property and sales taxes.
But I ask again, why hasn't it been done?
And the reason was, and the reason I mentioned the 2009 vote, I had a city council who was supported, you know, endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce, who got the money from those big donors, and they weren't going to raise taxes on the on big corporations. In fact, they eliminated taxes. I think we have a different council now. We just saw the income tax pass unanimously, something I supported. So I think that's something we have a shot at again moving forward, because I think the city has moved, and that type of conservative approach that we saw in the prior councils wouldn't be true moving forward.
We asked KUOW listeners to name Seattle's biggest challenge. Care to guess the overwhelming number one answer on our Facebook page?
Yeah, I'm guessing it's the same reason I got into the race, which is high prices and regressive taxes are pushing people out of town. How do we make it so people can afford to live here?
A lot of people specifically call out the cost of housing in this town.
Right.
What can you do about that?
Right. And I think there's two. I think there's many sides to this question. One is just we have to bring more housing into the marketplace.
And how do you do that?
Well, allowing backyard cottages, you know, what's come to be known as missing middle housing, duplexes, triplexes, small apartment buildings, you know, making it easier to bring that in instead of just only the big developments, make it easier to bring in a lot of different types, make it easier for somebody to have rent out part of their place or subdivide their house into multiple apartments. There are things we can do to bring more supply onto the market, things that I've consistently supported. I also think that the marketplace alone is never going to catch up. And that's why, as we were talking about, taxing corporations for affordable housing as an example, I mean, I think we really have to get much more dramatically into building affordable housing or buying it. You know, when an apartment building comes on the marketplace, that's maybe the city should use its eminent domain powers to buy that apartment building and operate it at a more affordable rate.
We make developers pay for affordable housing now, right?
Well, that's the thing, is we are asking developers to pay, and I support that. You know, I think you have to be careful about the rates you set, but that's only going to produce so many units of new affordable housing. I'm saying that we should have a broad-based tax and build more publicly owned housing.
Who pays that who's not paying now?
Well, that's why I keep talking about how do we tax the big corporations
that
are doing so well in the city.
So some of that goes for affordable housing.
Absolutely.
What about impact fees on developers? A lot of cities do that. Seattle doesn't.
Yeah. Well, in essence, the mandatory housing affordability that, you know, what you're talking about, asking developers to pay for affordable housing, that is the fee we're asking for.
Okay.
Today.
Most people, when they think impact fees, they think, well, because growth brings along, we got to have schools, we got to have parks, we got to have sidewalks.
Right.
But some people say, well, no, Seattle's already, we've done all that in Seattle.
Yeah. No, I think growth brings impacts. And right now, because our tax structure is so regressive, the impacts are paid for by those in the middle and the bottom. You know, if you wanted to design a system to drive out people out of town, this is what it would look like. You know, growth that benefits the wealthy with the costs of growth paid by for those at the middle and the bottom. So I think
you support a Seattle income tax, but you don't
absolutely.
Do you think it's going to happen and get through the courts or not?
I hope it will. And if it does, that will be great. That'll solve a lot of problems. If it doesn't get through, I think we have to have a plan. I don't think we can just be, you know, hoping. You know, hope alone isn't a plan.
Not just hope. This is Mike McGinn, more than hope. He's the former mayor and a candidate for mayor now. You talked about mid-level housing, duplexes, triplexes, et cetera. What about even more upzoning of single-family neighborhoods, the kind that got taken, that Mayor Murray proposed and then took off the table after the outcry?
And that's exactly the type of thing we're talking about here. You are going to have to look at the zoning in the city to accomplish some of what I talked about. You know, but a lot of that is, I mean, people right now can tear down their house and build a 4,000-square-foot house. Why not be able to build 3,000 or 4,000-square-foot, you know, houses in the same size building, you know, and that's a change we could make. I think there's a really another important piece of this. And part of the reason that these changes were taken off the table was because the process that the mayor did was very top down. It was dictated to the neighborhoods. And I think that you have to find a way to go into communities and ask them what matters to them. And I think you're going to find a lot of support for changes in our land use rules. But I also think you're going to find people are going to say, hey, we want to hear about sidewalks and parks and public safety and small businesses. So if you're going to make changes, you have to engage people in that change and be able to meet them. And if you do that, you know, meet their concerns, on infrastructure, I think things will go a lot smoother in terms of making changes to the city. People want quality of life at the end of the day. Okay. You got to talk to them about how to do that.
You said no dictating to neighborhoods. So let's say a North Seattle neighborhood says, Mayor McGinn, your own slogan was keep Seattle, and we agree. We want to keep our single family zoning.
Yeah.
Then what do you do? I mean,
well, this is the balance, right?
Don't you have to dictate at some point?
But you have to listen first. You have to listen before you make a decision. Because the fact is that we're part of a city, we're part of a region. You know, so if you look at a neighborhood, for example, that's getting light rail, that's being paid for by the entire region, that neighborhood has to acknowledge that they need to participate in having growth near that railroad station.
What if there's no light rail station right there?
You know, if you look around the city, there are bus lines all over the place. Everybody has a role to play in how we deal with growth. So I don't believe and I don't support that neighborhoods get to dictate their own either. You know, you have to go and talk to people. And again, I think you're going to find if you do that, that neighborhoods have lots of different viewpoints. People in neighborhoods have lots of different viewpoints. There's going to be a lot, you know, there are a lot of folks saying, where's my houses? That's what the millennials are saying. Where's my apartment building? Where's my place in the city? They live in neighborhoods too. And when we hear those voices, and it's not just the city telling a neighborhood how things are supposed to work, but people in a community listening to each other and saying, here are the other things we want to see with it, that's how you make change. And I think that's a challenge. That's something, I listen to all the other candidates. Hey, here's my idea, right? And I'll do this and I'll do that. That's not how government works. You know, you have to have a strong point of view. You have to have strong objectives, but you also have to listen to people and you have to bring people into that dialogue first. That's how you build the strength for change.
Didn't you have a reputation for sometimes not listening and not getting along with your city council?
Well, it just depends who you're talking to. If people thought that we should give homeless people, you know, tickets instead of services, yeah, I had a difference of opinion with them. If they thought the answer to transportation was more highways instead of transit, sure we did. But if you go talk to a lot of people, you know, particularly in our immigrant and refugee communities, they'll tell you City Hall was never more open than when I was mayor.
Well, let's talk about, I know you clashed with some city council members over police reform, and we have a question on KOW's Facebook page. Elizabeth says, do you feel that the Seattle Police consent decree, that's the federal order to change how police use force and address the perception of bias. She says, do you feel the Seattle Police consent decree was effective?
Right now, with what has happened, I think we need an independent third-party audit, and I would call on the Community Police Commission to run that audit to answer that question, because I think the public has lost trust with what they're seeing happening, or are losing trust with what they're seeing happen.
How about you? Have you lost faith in the consent decree process in police reform in Seattle?
What just happened is so...
Are we talking about the shooting of Charlena Lyles?
Yes. It doesn't feel like we've made the progress we're supposed to make. So my answer to your question is yes, and that's why I would call on the Community Police Commission, because I just don't think we can count on elected officials to keep telling us everything is all right. That's what they've been doing the last 3 years. And I think it's time to stop the self-congratulation on the success of the consent decree and take a real hard look at whether it's working or not. And again, I think we need the community and the Community Police Commission to have oversight of that independent review.
Are you saying you have drawn lessons from that police shooting of Charlena Lyles before the investigation is over?
Of the shooting itself?
Yes, yes.
The things that have been said in public about what were the policies about what non-lethal weapons someone should carry, it changed. For the first few days, we heard different stories about what the policy was. We heard different stories about what the policy was in dealing with someone in crisis. If this has been the highest priority of reform, is to make sure everybody's fully trained and knowledgeable about how to deal with people in crisis, then how come we can't even get a straight answer as to what the policies were going in? So that gives me serious concern. I know it gives the public serious concern. And that's why I think we need not just an investigation of that incident, but we need actually an independent, you know, kind of audit of the reform process. And if people are serious about reform, they'll welcome, you know, new set of eyes to look at it, because it's too important an issue for us to just try to the elected officials and the monitor and the court to say, don't worry, we got it. I don't think that's what the public thinks right now.
For Seattle mayoral candidate Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle as well, KOW's Facebook page has a question from Zach, who says Seattle's biggest challenge is addressing its own white supremacy. How racist do you think Seattle is?
You know, I was inside. I was inside government, and I got to see the way in which large sums of money or policies went through without almost any examination. But when I pushed to expand the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, council blocked it. They said, where's the data? When I pushed to expand Career Bridge, which was a program to aid returning felons, council blocked it and said, where's the data? I remember meeting with the black pastors. They said, how come it's only the programs that support black people that get that close level of scrutiny? What's that about? And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the donor class and the lobbyist class is very successful in the city of Seattle at directing dollars their way. And by the time you're done with that, there's just not enough left to deal with other urgent problems. I got into some trouble for questioning how much money we were giving to a museum that wanted money for rebuilding. This was very early in my term. And at the same time, I was having to reduce hours in community centers that served our most vulnerable communities. And, you know, that to me was an example of when I asked to, hey, can we talk about the deal on how much money we're giving this museum, which is a great museum. It's a great cause. I'm not criticizing them. But when I asked to talk about that, the council, you know, pounced and said that was divisive because I was saying, well, what can we do to keep our community centers open for the youth of color that live down in Rainier Valley? So yeah, it's real. It's real. It's embedded. There's a reason they call it institutional, because it's deep into the institutions.
We've been talking with candidate for mayor Mike McGinn. You can find more questions on KUOW's Facebook page. I'll give you the last word, though. Those are some listener questions. What do you want to say heading into 3 weeks now before primary ballots are due?
Well, you know, I guess what I want to say is, you know, getting to be mayor for 4 years was an absolute gift that I just was an extraordinary experience. And I've been watching what's happening with this city. And I want to take everything I learned in that 4 years. I want to take what the people taught me. You know, I did over 100 town halls. I was always in the community, always listening. And I want to take what they taught me, and I want to put that to work for Seattle, because I think we got big problems. And I don't think we need to, you know, look for candidates who are going to figure out the job. I can get in there. I can get to work right away. I've got relationships and communities across Seattle. And I'm a little older. I'm a little wiser, I hope. I'm definitely more humble. And, you know, a little more mellow, too, but still passionate about what makes a great city.
He's done the job. Mike McGinn, former mayor of Seattle, in the race to be mayor now. And your primary ballot is due 3 weeks from today, Tuesday, August 1st. Mike McGinn, thanks for talking with us again.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record, back at you in just a moment. Seattle's top money earners would be the only Washington State residents to pay an income tax if a new city law is upheld. Yesterday, the City Council unanimously voted to impose a 2.25% tax on personal income of more than $250,000 for individuals. For couples filing jointly, it's $500,000. The tax faces a court challenge from opponents who say it's illegal, unconstitutional, and a waste of taxpayer money. My first guest is a software engineer who lives in Seattle, Ashok Chandawani. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Your income is pretty high and it's rising, and you say you would pay this tax eventually, right?
Yeah, I certainly would. I make over the $250,000 threshold now, though I think I do enough charitable giving that this year I wouldn't pay it if it does manage to make it through the court challenge in time for this year.
And why do you support this Seattle income tax?
Yeah, I support the Seattle income tax for a couple of reasons. First off, I think there's some pretty huge ways that the city being able to collect more money and do more things benefits me and improves my quality of life. I commute to work and to the other places I go in the world on roads that were built and are maintained by the city government. I use Metro, and I would benefit from those things being improved. I use the library, and that benefits me pretty directly. I also support this, though, because it's just flat out the right thing to do. It doesn't really make sense to me that currently working people who have been getting pushed out of the city for years and are still getting pushed out of the city because it's unaffordable are the people who are paying the highest percentage of their income in state and local taxes. make the government run.
You know, you call it the right thing to do. This gets at the morality, the ethics of an income tax. And to quote my late father, Robin Hood was a really nice guy, he said, but it was still wrong to steal from the rich. And that's how he felt about income taxes, that the moral thing to do was not to take money from one person just because they earned it and give it to another person. So make that moral case.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because what our current system does now is also take money disproportionately from a specific group of people and redistribute it to everyone's benefit. The difference is right now we're taking the disproportionately high amount of money from working people, from people who make the least, whereas people, the wealthiest in Seattle, are paying under 3% of their income in taxes. So it's kind of backwards, really. Like, we're asking poor people to pay the most and wealthy people to pay the least.
Well, if
that certainly doesn't seem fair either.
Yes. So you support the income tax, Ashok, but you say that you make enough charitable contribution that so far you wouldn't pay it. Why not reduce your charitable giving so you can help out the city now, pay this tax sooner? Do we still have you, Ashok?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I suppose I would say I believe really deeply in a lot of the charitable giving that I do, and I've made long-term commitments to several of the organizations I give to. I also don't think my, let's say I make $255,000 this year. The 2% of the $5,000 over the threshold that I would make isn't really going to make or break the city budget. Now, of course, I would support this completely if it was taxing my entire income at 2% or even more. I think that would be great. I would love to be able to contribute to the city in that way.
What about the argument that this would threaten business in the state? This is an argument Steve Ballmer and others make, that we're going to kill the golden goose and hurt the economy.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I understand there's a relatively high income tax in Silicon Valley, California, that hasn't seemed to damage industry there. I would also say that I'm not really enthused about the idea of people moving into this area, which is where I grew up and where I think I'll probably live for most of my life, just because it's a tax shelter. I think there are a lot of great reasons to live here aside from that.
Yeah, so maybe weed out the people who are only here because of a low tax burden.
Well, I'm also not sure that I know anyone who's only here because of the low tax rate. And I think a lot of people, if there are such people, I think if they kind of get critical with themselves and think through what it means that working people are paying 16% of their income in taxes so that we all can benefit, that just seems kind of ridiculous on its surface.
Well, then, Ashok, what would be too high an income tax? Like, right now, the new tax is 2.25%, applying above $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a married couple filing jointly. Is that the right amount? And would there be any amount that would make you say, that's too much, I am moving out of here?
I think what I would rather focus on is moving away from the current model of taxation that we have, where it's the flat taxes like the sales tax and the property tax. Because I think something that an income tax lets us do is it lets us say, we know it costs X dollars to live here, so we're not going to tax you up to that point. And then in that way, we can just say, everyone should be able to afford the cost of living, and we can tax people's kind of disposable income instead of making it harder for people to live here.
Okay, so it sounds like you don't want to pick a number that's the right number or too high an income tax rate?
Well, I mean, I'm not a tax expert. I'm not a budget expert.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. You're a software engineer, and you're doing well enough that you think you eventually would pay this Seattle income tax if it is upheld. I've been talking with Ashok Chandawani on KUOW. Thanks for this, Ashok.
Thank you.
Good to talk with you. Now, let's get another point of view on this. My next guest is Michelle Delep, who is an attorney for Garvey Schubert Bear. And Michelle, you don't support the city income tax. You've been writing legal arguments against it. Why is that?
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I do not think that this is a legal tax. It's not going to withstand a legal challenge, I believe. So I'm concerned about the city moving forward with it.
And we're about to tell the listener the back history of why it's not constitutional. So that story's coming up. But just for to keep us up to speed, someone who's listening, you know, that we're listening to you right now trying to follow you, could you summarize why you think this is an illegal tax?
Well, the very first thing I think a court would look at is whether the city has the power to pass this type of tax. All of us who live in Seattle know that the city can pass a lot of different types of taxes, but this particular type of tax is not within the scope of the city's authority. The city's authority is limited.
Yes, and again, we'll tell the story of what happened to that on that Supreme Court so many decades ago. But do you think that the state of Washington could change its tax structure? Let's say if it meant amending the Constitution, would that happen?
Yeah, in terms of what the state can do with the state tax structure, mm-hmm. that would require a constitutional amendment. You know, Governor Evans tried to do that in the 1960s. Governor Booth tried in the 1980s. People have been making efforts on this. The problem is there has not been the political will among the voters to change our tax structure in that way.
You know, I asked our previous guest about the morality of this. He said this is the right thing to do, to tax the people who have to help the people who are struggling. What is your case about that? What's the morally right thing to do? Doesn't that sound right? Make the people who have pay their fair share?
You know, the ethical failing that I see here has to do with the city moving forward with a case that it should know will not survive in court, this ordinance, and that it will be a colossal waste of time and money.
Okay, so for you, the ethical case has to do with whether the city should spend taxpayer money on a legal fight. But I'm still curious to know how you feel about the rightness or wrongness, because I quoted my dad earlier, who felt like that was a Robin Hood-style stealing from the rich. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the ethics of an income tax?
You know, there has been a lot of inflammatory language, tax the rich. I think that everybody should have skin in the game. And so in terms of a progressive tax, you know, a progressive tax is not a panacea. I think the state of Oregon can vouch for that. They've been really struggling with their tax structure as well and looking north to us to think about whether gross receipt tax might give them more stability. Income tax is a very volatile tax, so you really have to take a step back and look at the whole picture.
So if a Seattle income tax were legal and you could vote on it, would you vote yes or no?
If it were legal and I could vote on it and it is only taxing the rich, I would not vote on it.
You would not vote on it?
I would not vote for it.
Yeah. And why is that?
I just believe everyone should have skin in the game. And actually, like your prior interviewee, Ashok, I think that, you know, there should be, you know, a carve out like we have in our federal income tax system where people, you know, have enough to survive before they start paying it over in taxes. But this tax only affects a very small group of people. And so I think it is shading towards demagoguery at its worst.
Okay, we've been talking with attorney Michelle Delep, who if there's a legal fight against the city income tax, and it looks like that's assured, are you going to be involved in the legal fight?
I would love to argue this case. We're watching it closely.
You'd love to. Where does the love come in?
It is a very interesting legal issue, and it's always nice, you know, to be on the side that looks like it would prevail.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Delep, attorney for Garvey Schubert Bearer, as we head into a promised legal fight over this brand new Seattle income tax. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
Now, the idea behind Seattle's income tax, as you probably know, is to ease the burden of what are called more regressive taxes, sales taxes, property taxes. Governments in Washington state end up using those taxes a lot. We don't have a statewide income tax in Washington. We almost had one, though. Almost. This was decades ago, and KUOW's Carolyn Adolph is here to tell you the story.
Actually, the people of Washington state did approve an income tax. It was during the Great Depression. A lot of people were down and out.
Once I lived a life of a millionaire.
And people were so excited about the income tax, they voted twice. First, they changed the state constitution to allow the tax, and then voters approved the tax itself. 70% in favor in 1932.
It was more popular on that ballot than bringing back the sale of beer.
This is
Jeff Crooks. I am a former commissioner of the Supreme Court.
And he knows the story because its surprise ending happened here. The Washington State Supreme Court in Olympia.
Okay, so we're entering the Temple of Justice.
The income tax was a hit because people who made very little money would pay very little. And remember, this was the Great Depression. A lot of people had very little money. But business people could see where this was leading. They'd be expected to pay a lot. So they challenged the tax in court, saying it couldn't be legal. And by the middle of 1933, that challenge made it to this courtroom, which has barely changed since then. Same leather-bound chairs.
2, 4, 6, 8.
Nine.
Still nine.
Still nine.
But the day of the hearing, the ninth judge failed to appear. In the hall by the clerk's office, you can see portraits of the judges involved.
There's Parker, Tolman, let's see, who else? But one thing you see that's obvious here, they're all old white guys.
But the drama swirls around just one, Emmett Parker.
So Parker, he was the guy who was too ill to sit.
Parker had a heart condition and couldn't make it to the hearing. Without him, the judges deadlocked. 4 in favor, 4 against. But the state needed a decision, and the governor, Clarence Martin, needed the income tax. So he appointed a new judge who shared his views.
And then everybody expected that the court would uphold the income tax.
This is Hugh Spitzer, a law professor at the University of Washington.
But lo and behold, when it was re-argued, they voted it down 5-4.
The income tax was dead. What happened? One thing we know is that the mail happened. By the time the state Supreme Court heard the case a second time, people were already getting their income tax forms. Suddenly, the tax wasn't just a theory. It was real, and the form made it look like even people with no money would have to pay. But did the arrival of the tax form actually change a Supreme Court verdict? Possibly. Hugh Spitzer says he spoke with one of the last known witnesses to the proceedings, a lobbyist named Charles Hoddy.
And Charlie told me that he was quite sure that what really happened in 1933 is that the judges received their tax statements in the mail before they had decided the case. And once they took a look at their tax statements, of course, judges got paid, they had decent jobs. And then some judge decided he didn't want to pay that tax. Now, that's what Charlie said.
What we do know is that one of the judges changed his mind, and that judge is likely to be Oscar Holcomb. He's the one who wrote the decision that declared the income tax against the state constitution. And it's strange, because on the same day that the income tax died in Washington, the state Supreme Court approved another income tax. It's the business and occupations tax. Jeff Crooks sits in front of the judges' portraits and reads their decision.
It may be that we have, in some prior case, used language not wholly consistent with our present views. In some prior case was the one that they had just decided. And
the B&O tax was supposed to be temporary.
It's hard not to laugh.
Hard not to laugh, because it's still one of the principal taxes we rely on.
And that's where we are today.
Hugh Spitzer.
We still have a 1935 tax system.
Which is exactly the way the people of Washington appear to want it. A state income tax has come up for a vote half a dozen times since that Supreme Court decision. And every time, voters have rejected it. I'm Carolyn Adolph for Local Wonder.
Carolyn produced that story in 2015, and here's another way to enjoy that story. You can share this with your friends. We have put together an animated video illustrated by local artist Drew Christie, the animated story of the Washington State income tax that never was and maybe shall be. We're tweeting that out to you right now at KUOW. And coming up on the record, we have this tradition of Mariners fans cheering our pitching ace Felix Hernandez to strike out another batter. But what if Felix just isn't up to it anymore? Should we still be yelling at him to be a strikeout king? That's coming up on KUOW's The Record in about 10 minutes. KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. Seattle's TV news might get a little more conservative. A right-leaning corporation called Sinclair Broadcast Group wants to buy Seattle station Q13. Sinclair already owns Seattle's Como 4. Comedian John Oliver calls Sinclair the most influential media company you've never heard of.
Sinclair can sometimes dictate the content of your local newscast as well. And in contrast to Fox News, a clearly conservative outlet where you basically know what you're getting, with Sinclair, they are injecting Fox-worthy content into the mouths of your local news anchors.
Let's learn more about this from Washington Post media reporter Paul Fari. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Good, thank you. Fox-worthy content in the mouths of local anchors. Is that true of Sinclair?
It's generally true. Not all of their programs that they distribute to their local stations are conservative, but quite a number, particularly during the campaign, certainly were. And nowadays, with Trump battling the press, they've come out sort of foursquare in favor of the Trump administration. So generally speaking, that is an accurate adjective for them.
My understanding is that sometimes Sinclair just provides readers for local anchors to read. Is that right? That would be the mouths of local anchors. Is that right?
Well, they hand out must-run packages. Must-run means the stations are required as part of being owned by Sinclair to put these on their newscasts. You will find a spot somewhere in your newscast throughout the day to run that programming. And they send with it a script to introduce the whole package of stories.
Here's a sample of one of those must-runs. This is a Sinclair-produced critique of fake news that aired here on Como 4 in Seattle.
National media outlets are publishing these fake news stories without fact-checking. Unfortunately, some members of the national media are using their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think.
Pushing an agenda to control what you think, which, ironically, isn't that what Sinclair's critics are accusing them of here, is pushing their agenda through these must-run commentaries?
Yes, that's absolutely what Sinclair is doing and wants to do. None of its commentators are from a liberal perspective. They're not even necessarily from a centrist perspective. They tend to take a conservative line. And those are the things that are the must-runs, the conservative commentaries that Sinclair puts out. They do want you to look at it from the conservative perspective, and they do believe that the rest of the media is liberal and they are the counterweight.
Who are some of these commentators who are on these must-run pieces from Sinclair?
Well, one of their commentators, newly hired in April, is a fellow named Boris Epstein. Who is Boris Epstein? Well, you may remember him from the campaign when he was a surrogate in the employ of the Trump campaign. He later went on to become a White House press aide. And since April, he's been the top political analyst for Sinclair Broadcast Group. And there really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of difference between his role as a Trump surrogate and a Trump press spokesman and a political analyst for Sinclair Broadcast Group.
Well, as John Oliver said a moment ago, we already have partisan commentary on Fox and MSNBC and in our Facebook feeds. So why should local TV be any different?
There's a real argument that says it shouldn't be any different. Opinions are everywhere. We're all in the opinion business because of our Facebooks and our Twitters and our social media. There's nothing to be ashamed of. What's dangerous or what's pernicious is when the opinions creep into the news and you can't tell the difference. And when those lines blur, then people can't figure out where someone is coming from and why they're saying what they're saying. And whether it's news or if it's opinion, that's where the confusion comes in.
And there's more of a danger of that because people don't know, don't expect to get commentary on their local TV station as opposed to Fox News?
Well, I think that's been generally true for quite a while. There isn't all that much commentary on local news. A lot of stations are afraid of it. A lot of stations don't want the hassle that comes from viewers calling them up and saying, I disagree. So they've shied away from commentary on the local news. It tends to be news, weather, and sports. And so you don't have someone getting on there to tell you what to think or to give their opinion. I remember a time when this was more common. I think it has become less common over time. Perhaps you could say that Sinclair is just taking us back to an earlier age in television when the local newscast did have a guy who would get on there or a woman who would get on there and give an opinion.
Is Sinclair, in running its conservative commentaries, are they making a political decision that comes at the expense of their bottom line, or is being more conservative these days a business decision?
Well, it's a niche, and Fox News discovered this much to their great profit when they started about 20 years ago. There are plenty of conservative viewers in this country, there are plenty of conservative readers, and now we have a real diversity of stations and news sources and commentary sources around. So by being the conservative or identifiably conservative outlet, maybe they're appealing to that niche, and trying to steer that middle ground is no longer a good model for them. I think in the main, I would say, however, that much of the news that Sinclair stations present really isn't from the left or from the right. It's pretty much, you know, undistinguished from any of the other stations in town. It looks a lot like it. They do some good investigative work. They're not only conservative. So it's unfair to them to say that they're turning all these stations into conservative stations. They are adding a lot of conservative elements, though, and it's all being dictated out of one central source. The other aspect of that is Sinclair is getting bigger and bigger, and so their power is expanding all the time. They're about to close on this purchase of Tribune Media Company, which will add about 42 more stations, but significantly larger stations to their portfolio. So they will be able to have a much wider reach with all of the things that they do. And conservative commentary and some conservative news reporting, too, is one of the things they're going to do.
Yes, yeah, Seattle station Q13 is one of those Tribune stations that Sinclair would then own if this purchase goes through. Will it be allowed to go through?
I think so. I think that the fact that Sinclair has been an ally to the Trump administration, or at least has not been hostile to the Trump administration, bodes well for their desire to expand. The FCC seems to be friendly to this. These things kind of go hand in hand. Ask yourself what happens when Time Warner wants to merge with AT&T, which is a deal that's pending now. That might have a little bit tougher time, if only because Time Warner owns CNN and the Trump administration is a little bit at odds with CNN these days. So keep an eye on that one. That might end up being one that they want to hold up for what might be political purposes.
Paul Fahrey is the media reporter for The Washington Post. If Sinclair's purchase of Tribune Media goes through, it's estimated that company will own TV stations that reach more than 70% of households in America, including one more here in Seattle. And thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record.
Seattle Mariners, Felix Hernandez, the 2-2.
He got him! 34 years, 119 games. It's finally happened. A perfect game by a Seattle Mariner. It was done by the King, Felix Hernandez.
The King, Felix Hernandez, pitching a perfect game on August 15th, 2012. And those cheering fans you heard, that was the King's Court. If you've been to a Mariners game at Safeco, you know the King's Court. The fans along the third base line all wearing the yellow shirts or sometimes dressed in King costumes, holding signs with a K on them, chanting for Felix to strike out the next batter. It is a beloved Mariners tradition that my next guest wants to change. Seattle Times sports columnist Larry Stone, welcome to KUOW.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Larry, you argue it's time for fans to stop chanting for King Felix Hernandez to strike guys out because he's old?
Well, not because he's old, just because he's a different kind of pitcher now. When the King's Court started in 2011, he was coming off his Cy Young year. He was young. He threw hard. He was a intimidating strikeout type pitcher, and now he's 31. He's got 2,000 innings on his arm. He's a different kind of pitcher. Now they want him to be a different kind of pitcher. They don't want him to have that persona of being a strikeout pitcher. So it just seems to me that to have people in your own parks chanting KKK when they want Felix to be a guy who pitches to contact, who economizes his pitches so he can get deeper into the game, and sort of the new focus of a guy who doesn't throw 98 miles an hour like he did when they started this thing.
Larry, what do you want us to? Yeah, that's the King's Court loves Felix too. So what do you want him to do? Chant economize.
Yeah, well, I don't want to disband the King's Court because I think it's great. It's a lot of fun, and fun at the ballpark is what it's all about. Just cheer for outs, you know. Just wear your garb and don't wave the K signs anymore. It's just and then trust me, there's people in the organization who believe the same thing.
King Felix, we would accept a lazy pop out if it doesn't advance the runner. It just doesn't really have the same ring.
It sure doesn't. No, like weak grounder to short.
Right.
Weak grounder to short.
You will have done your job. So wait a minute. You said something interesting. The team, the Mariners, want to ease Felix Hernandez out of the strikeout persona.
Nobody will say anything about discontinuing King's Court because they know that that's popular with the fans. But in a private moment, they'll say that they don't think it's it jives with what they want him to do. And you have to face reality. Pitchers just don't throw like he did for a long. I mean, he did for 10, 12 years, which is great. But that's taken a toll on his arm. And if you try to be that pitcher, when you don't have that stuff, you know, two things can happen. Either you're going to get hit hard or, you're going to be wild and that's going to be just as bad. So,
but wait a minute. Are you saying that you've covered baseball a long time? Are you saying major league pitchers are actually affected by what we want them to be? Like, can he hear them chanting, and he feels like, I guess I got to strike somebody out?
Scott Servais, the manager, made a comment to that effect in spring training. He's only human, and that when you hear that people chanting for you to strike out, you want to satisfy them, and so I do think Felix is a guy who feeds off the emotion and the energy, and I think it does play on his mind a little bit, subconsciously, consciously, or whatever.
You hear that, fans? Larry Stone says you're hurting him.
Well, it didn't hurt him on Sunday when my column appeared and he went out and pitched his best game of the year. Shut out the A's on two hits and struck out, I think, eight. So he shut me up. On Sunday.
Maybe he was responding to you. If he can hear the fans, he surely can read the columnists.
Well, I don't want to say, make it seem like I think I'm all powerful, but it wouldn't surprise me if he was if that lit a fire under him a little bit.
Well, write some more columns about him being ineffective and aged. What is Felix Hernandez himself? Have you asked him what he thinks of your idea?
I haven't had a chance to know. I mean, he's a big supporter of the King's Court and loves it, and I'm sure he would shoot down what I'm saying.
Okay. You know why I liked your argument? This is Larry Stone from Seattle Times. I liked your column. I didn't think about that the cheering in the King's Court would actually affect Felix Hernandez, but what I liked is that I felt like you were saying it's time to deal with reality, which is hard for all of us. We're all aging. And we don't realize how time has passed, and you just need to kind of realize where you are.
Exactly. You can't detract from what Felix has done and what he's meant to this organization, which is everything. He's been the face of the team for a decade and a loyal guy who had a couple opportunities to go sign elsewhere for bigger money. He ended up signing a huge contract to stay with the Mariners with a no-trade clause because he didn't want to be traded later down the road. He wants to make his life here. His family are in the schools and all that. And he can still be a really good pitcher even at 31 with all the innings logged. It just has to do it a little bit differently. And, as soon as he embraces that, I think it's the better for everyone involved. And, he knows it. It's just a hard transition to make.
Yeah, that we can cheer for him to be the pitcher that he can be instead of cheering for Muhammad Ali when the poor guy's getting beaten up. We just need to shift our game. Last question, Larry. Do you think the Mariners have any chance? What are the odds they make it to the playoffs?
Well, I do think they have a chance. I've liked this team from the beginning. They've had their surges, but then they've had their valleys, which have been kind of puzzling. But you know, through it all, and a lot of injuries, four-fifths of their starting rotation was on the DL at one point in the first half. They're still four games out of the wild card race, and you know, four games could be erased with one hot streak. So, you know, it's been 16 years since they've been in the playoffs. 2001, the last time. Fans are getting understandably impatient and frustrated, but you know, this team's four games under 500, which doesn't seem to be a jumping off point for the playoffs, but I do think they have a run in them.
All right, you're sure we shouldn't stop cheering for them to be a playoff team when they're just they don't have it in them anymore? Just let them be third place. Larry Stone from the Seattle Times, thanks for the column and thanks for talking with us.
All right, Bill, my pleasure.
Finally, on KUOW's The Record, be careful what you say in an email. The New York Times has reported that during the presidential campaign, Donald Trump Jr. brought Jared Kushner and Trump's campaign chair, Paul Manafort, to a meeting with a Russian lawyer. Okay, well, today, the Times reports that Trump Jr. got an email that explicitly laid out what might happen at that meeting. And we have the entire email. We have the exchange. A senior Russian government official had dirt on Hillary Clinton, and Trump Jr. knew that. The email says, quote, "This is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump." And Donald Trump Jr. emailed back, quote, "If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer." That might not be collusion, but it sure is awkward. Have you ever sent an email you shouldn't have sent? And what happened next? We would like to know on KUOW's Facebook page. Let us know. Or leave us a voicemail, 206-221-3663. That's 221-3663. Or you could email us at record@kuow.org. record@kuow.org. But maybe before you send that email, just write a draft of it first. Just let it sit for a while so you don't regret it. Or here's one more piece of advice from Marketplace Weekend host Lizzie O'Leary. She tweeted, "Never email when you can text. Never text when you can talk on the phone. Never talk on the phone when you can meet in person." And then Lizzie tweeted, "Never tweet." Let us know your story. KUOW is The Record. Thanks for tuning in and telling us your tale of email woe.